Well, I am wearing an athletic type of shirt. I needed to wear something athletic because the passage this morning is Hebrews chapter 12. I invite you to turn there. Hebrews chapter 12, and it's a chapter that is an athletic image there. I was thinking, you know, athletic, what do I wear? It's so controversial. I mean, I'd like to wear Montreal Canadiens jersey, but that's a pretty short-term investment. Sorry, Pastor Serge. It's July 4th. I mean, I should wear some American, shouldn't I? I can't wear Tampa Bay Lightning because then I don't know what would happen. Serge would probably walk out. But so I chose, and I'm by the way, I'm a Calgary Flames fan. I could wear an Edmonton Oilers jersey, but I would feel like I'm a traitor to my people. So I picked a University of Minnesota Golden Gophers, right? They're pretty tame, right? You can't really get in trouble for a Golden Gopher. I got it because I grew up on the prairies, and apparently the Olds Colleges, they're the Gophers as well. But the Golden Gophers, they're real timid. You can't really get in too much trouble with Golden Gophers, at least I don't think so. So Golden Gophers, Minnesota. What do you talk about when you run out of things to talk about? This last year, man, it seems like we could talk about COVID or masking or something, and it would bring up all sorts of opinions and conflict, and probably easier to talk about the Edmonton-Calgary rivalry than it is to talk about the COVID or something like that. If you want to strike up a conversation with people, if you want to change the topic, but have, you know, keep the conversation rolling along, ask them what discipline was like for their family as they were growing up. And you can trade all sorts of war stories about growing up. Like, I grew up in a home where there was five of us boys, no girls. We were always wrestling and fighting and doing things and breaking things. And we used to tease my dad that he would line us up every morning and say, "You're going to need it at some time during the day, so we may as well start the day off with it." But discipline, what was discipline like for you in your home growing up? Some of the things that I said I was never going to say to my kids, you know, if you don't stop crying, I'm going to give you something to cry about. Or this is going to hurt you more than it hurts me. Like, I always wanted to say, right, let me try changing roles. No. But we had, all of us had discipline as we were growing up, and it's something you can strike up a conversation with people about, get their thoughts and opinions. But psychologists for years have been talking about this because there's a relationship between parenting styles and discipline and love and outcomes of the children. Now, there's not a direct relationship in the sense that it is 100% of the time and it will take place, but the pattern is so strong between parenting styles and outcomes of the children that psychologists decades ago broke it up into four different parenting styles. They started off with three and then they added a fourth. Now there's a fifth and so on. But basically, it's with two different continuums, a continuum of a home or a parenting style where there's a high degree or a low degree of control. Then there's a parenting style at the same time that will have a high degree or a low degree of warmth expressed in the home. Different terminologies used for this: warmth or responsiveness or love, control or discipline. And they've described a home that is high in control and high in warmth as an authoritative home, an authoritative home. These are homes where there's a reciprocal sort of environment. There's high expectations, but there are clear standards. There is assertiveness, but there's also, some have even described it as democratic, but it doesn't mean there's a vote on everything. But it means that the parents in this home, if there's a term to describe it, that these parents would say is, let's talk about that. Let's talk about that. Now, in those homes where there is a low degree of warmth and there's a high degree of control, this has been described as an authoritarian home. In this home, there is punishment, there's clear rules, there's an emotional distancing of the parents to the children, there's little warmth, there's high expectations. It's very structured environments. And if there's a word or a phrase that would describe parents in this home, it's because I said so. Now, and you may find that you grew up in some of these homes, or you might find even that, now, this is a continuum. There may be different sort of ways you even treat some of your kids different than others because of how they respond to discipline or how they respond to warmth and so on. But in those homes where there's a high degree of affirmation or warmth and a low degree of control, has been described as a permissive home. Even some psychologists term this as an indulgent home. This is where confrontation is avoided. There's few rules. There's very much acceptance and non-directive, low expectations. In a home where there's low warmth and low control, this has been described as an uninvolved home, and some describe it as a neglectful home. This is where the parents are perhaps uninterested. It feels that way, at least. There are competing priorities. There's little time for the kids. They're absent, uninvolved. Now, the kids that come from these different type of homes, there's such a strong pattern that psychologists tried to work with different parenting things to teach parents how to parent differently, but in authoritative homes, this is where the kids are the most well-adjusted for adulthood, able to handle things the best. In homes where it's permissive or called indulgent, these are the ones that actually end up not achieving as well in school and after high school and job and that sort of stuff. Kids from permissive homes are three times more likely in high school to be involved in alcohol and drugs. That is not to say that every time a kid participates in one of those things, they must be from a permissive home. That's not what I'm saying. But a permissive home is far more likely to have kids act out in that kind of a way. In an authoritarian home, these are kids who have very low self-esteem. These are ones that have difficulty with attachment afterwards. And these are the ones that produce the most skilled liars. They know how to get things over on their parents. They spend a lifetime doing that. Uninvolved homes, these are the ones that are most juvenile delinquents come from. This is where their parents are just not involved. There's neither love nor control, at least felt by the child. And in uninvolved homes, they find it difficult to attach, especially afterwards, because they don't know what it means to have a meaningful relationship. These are the ones, matter of fact, that Hebrews 12 picks up on, and I think it becomes those who in verse 9 of Hebrews 12, we're going to get to this, but they feel like they are illegitimate children because the parents are just not involved enough to either show love and show warmth or to discipline. Well, we're coming to this passage in Hebrews 12, which is a passage in the Bible about discipline. This is the passage that speaks about God's discipline. And in our time together this morning, what I want to get to, and by the way, the title of this message is The Discipline of a Dad Coach. And I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. But where I want to come to at the end is that we would recognize that God's discipline that discipline is the sweet, sometimes painful reality of a relationship with a loving father. Discipline is the sweet, sometimes painful reality of a relationship with a loving father. So let's get ready to read through up to verse 13 in Hebrews chapter 12. Riley spoke last week from verses 1 and 2. We're going to read them again, but as we prepare to go into this, I want you to notice something, that this has with it the imagery or the picture of athleticism, or let me say it this way. First point in your bulletins is the Christian life is like a marathon. The Christian life is like a race. It jumps out at us through this passage. You can't miss it. Matter of fact, verse 1 says, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, this is kind of like the cheering section, or maybe this is the Hall of Fame, just come from chapter 11, which is all these people that have gone before and had great examples of faith, but this great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. It's a picture of weight around your feet and things that are weighing you down. And he says, and here you go, let us run with endurance the race marked out for us. The Christian life is like a marathon. It's not like a sprint. It's like a marathon. It's like an athletic thing. This is what's going on in this passage. And let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you do not grow weary and lose heart. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. And you've forgotten the word of encouragement that addresses you as sons. My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline, and do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes everyone he accepts as a son. Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as sons. For what son is not disciplined by his father? And if you are not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are illegitimate children, not true sons. It doesn't feel like God is even your father, if that would be the case. Moreover, we have all had human fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of our spirits and live? Our fathers disciplined us for a little while as they thought best, but God disciplines us for our good, that we may share in his holiness. Now, no discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. That word trained there is the word we get the gymnasium from. You see the athletic imagery here? It continues. Therefore, strengthen your feeble arms and weak knees. Make level paths for your feet so that the lame may not be disabled but rather healed. The Christian life is like a marathon. Now, this may be a surprise to you. I have never run a marathon. Anyone here ever run a marathon? One, two, three? Wow, first service, there's only one. This is the condition group, I guess. I've never run a marathon. I hear it's hard work. I've run races, especially when I was younger. But being in a marathon requires a lot of discipline, and it requires a lot of endurance and motivation. You need to have the endurance to run, and so that endurance, second point, requires motivation and discipline. Motivation and discipline. Now, in this chapter, we're going to hear all about discipline, and this is really the discipline, like parenting kind of discipline, but it's merged together with this idea of athletics, of a marathon, of running. But the Christian life is like a marathon, and you need to have discipline and motivation. I want you to notice here that even in the very first bit, it says, let us run with endurance the race marked out before us. And it says, throw aside every weight and the sin that so easily entangles. It's like we throw off those weights, because if you're going to run a marathon, I haven't seen marathon runners travel with a whole lot of weight. Matter of fact, the very first marathon, or where we get marathon from, was because of the Battle of Marathon. And the Persians were going to, they sent a ship around, I think it was to Athens, and they were going to claim victory. And someone saw that they were sending this ship around to claim victory, and they set out a runner, because if they claimed victory, they would go into Athens and say, "We won, we won, we won." But they hadn't won. The Persians had lost, and so they sent a runner from Marathon, the town of Marathon, to Athens to tell the king, "No, the Greeks have won, not the Persians." And from that, we have Marathon. That guy that ran, as he was running, started taking his clothes off. By the time he arrived, apparently, he was stark naked. Early runners in the Olympics ran and competed without any clothes, because you didn't want to have all of this hindering you. Even the runners nowadays, they don't wear many clothes, if you've seen them. And so the picture here of a marathon runner is throwing aside every weight, and it requires endurance, and endurance requires motivation and discipline. Now, throughout the book of Hebrews, it has pointed us to the idea that the Christian life is like a marathon, and it's one where we've got to endure. You'll read that word many times in the book of Hebrews, and words like it: don't shrink back, don't turn back, don't turn aside, don't fall away, don't forget. Remember this, keep after these things. All throughout the book of Hebrews, it's a letter to Christians, I believe, that's saying, continue on in these things, don't shrink back from them. And so we need motivation. The writer to Hebrews, I've said this several times already, the writer to Hebrews gives us supreme motivation for why we should continue on in the Christian life, why we should continue to believe God, why we should continue to resist sin in our lives, why we should continue to obey Him. And the supreme motivation for that is because of the person and work of Jesus Christ. Matter of fact, of all of the motivations for why we should continue on, that's the supreme one. 10 chapters or 10 times over, it talks about Jesus Christ. He is greater than the prophets. He is greater than the angels. He is greater than Moses. He's greater than Abraham. He's greater than the whole Levitical priesthood system. He's greater than the priest. He's greater than the high priest. He is absolutely unique, Jesus Christ is. If you want a reason, if you're feeling like you just can't hang on, look to the work and person of Jesus Christ. So much so that the Apostle Paul in Romans 12 said, "I beg of you, because of God's mercy," or in view of God's mercy, "that you offer your bodies as a living sacrifice." 10 times over, the motivation for us in our Christian living is Jesus Christ. Now, God in His wisdom in Hebrews doesn't make it just that. There's a couple other motivations. Another motivation, I'll call the cloud of witnesses. These people who went before us in chapter 11, who were looking for the reward. It's right and fitting for us to be motivated in our Christian life for a reward, what God will have for us when we get to heaven. That we can forfeit that now. Not the getting to heaven part, because that is completely what Jesus Christ has done. That's not because of what we've done. We believe in Jesus Christ, and that is the way you get to heaven. But in living the Christian life and continuing on in that, there is reward that's in store. There's a whole list of people in Hebrews chapter 11 that tells about that. Well, another reason is the model of Jesus. This is kind of wedged in chapter 12. Looking unto Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. The model of Jesus. Jesus, now this is a minor thing, I would say, in some respects in regards to Christianity overall. A lot of people get confused in this. Yes, Jesus was a good teacher, good moral teacher. Yes, Jesus was a good living person. That's not why He came to earth, primarily at least. He came to earth to die for our sins, to take on human form, to pay the price for Brian Seward's sins. That's why Jesus came. But even in His coming, because He was God in flesh, He becomes a supreme example as well. He's a good model. You ought to follow Him. So if you're wondering how you endure persecution and difficulties, you look unto Jesus and see how He endured. But we come to this final reason in the book of Hebrews, motivation for why you should obey God, why you should continue on in the Christian life. And that's because of the love of the dad coach, I'll say, the love of the dad coach. It's an athletic picture here. It calls us to endure, to run, to this sort of stuff, and to do that, we're going to need motivation, we're going to need discipline. The word discipline is mentioned 11 times, depending on which translation you have. But 11 times in this chapter, discipline is key to all of this. But the stunning thing is that the one who is our coach is, in fact, our Father. Verse 5, and you have forgotten that word of encouragement that addresses you as sons. As sons. This isn't just an indifferent or someone who's passionate about the sport. This is, in fact, our Father, our Heavenly Father. Some of you have had great coaches. Maybe some of you have had poor fathers. I think you know, or you can imagine, even if you've had a poor father, you can imagine what it would be like to have a father who truly loved you, was not maybe just an authoritarian, he's going to do it my way, or the one who's like, whatever you say, son, we just kind of go with it your way. But a father who's firm and loving. That's our coach. That's the stunning part here. Matter of fact, some of you, to pick up on these next verses, some of you, you love the verses from Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. We hear them at baptisms all the time. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not unto your own understanding in all your ways. You've heard them. Maybe they're your favorite verses. I've yet to see a baptism that has the verses that follow. Just read a little bit further on in Proverbs 3. It's these words right here. My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline, and do not lose heart when he rebukes you. The Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes, even scourges is the word here, those he accepts as a son. I don't hear those at baptism. But did you know the expression of God's love? And this is not an abusive God. I hope we've covered that. This is not a sadistic God. This is a God who loves. And the disciplines that come into our lives are the result of a loving God. Let me backtrack a little bit here into this athletic model. Why would we need this loving sort of God to coach us, to be a father to us in this? It's because of this battle that we're in, this conquest that we're on, this, I don't like to call it a sport because it makes light of it, but the athletic model is a battle against sin. It's a battle against sin. It's really a throwdown with sin. Verse 3, or verse 1 brings it up first time. It says, and the sin that so easily entangles, the picture of the sin and weights around your feet or extra clothing and that sort of stuff. And then in verse 3, consider him, that is Jesus, who endured such opposition from sinful men. Same word. One is sin and then those who sin. Same word here. Jesus was embattled in a fight against sin. And then in verse 4 makes it really clear, in your struggle against sin. And in verse 3, the word struggle is a compound word that the first part of it is anti, meaning against. Anti, against. And the second part of it is to set down or to put down or even to throw down. And so really it's the throw down against. Our Christian walk, make no mistake about it, is a battle against sin. It's a throw down, gloves are off, bare knuckle fight against sin. Jesus had a battle with sin. Now when in Jesus' battle with sin, it was not him that battled sin within, it was sinful men, it says in verse 3. But it was a battle with sin. That's described. Historically, the Christian walk has been described as a war against the world, the flesh, and the devil. Now, you won't find a verse in the Bible that puts that all quite together like that. If you take a look at Jesus' temptation, you can see it and how it follows that. Temptation against the world, the flesh, the devil. My battle against sin, what is meant by that? How do I fight against sin? There's people out there, I've discovered, that are not necessarily happy with all of my existence. I don't find life super easy sometimes. We find both people around us, systems around us, the world around us that is full of wickedness, and people that would wish for my demise, would take my money, would take my home, would take my stuff, my family. There's even people that would wish me dead. If it came down to it and it was ferocious enough, there are people that wouldn't blink twice if they could take my life and my money at the same time. You know that battle. It's part of being part of this world. And then there's things that happen in this world that I didn't wish for, I didn't want, I don't like. All started because sin entered the world. And with sin came death. And loved ones who die, that's a result of sin. We struggle. If you've ever grieved, that's a struggle with sin. And I don't mean grieving is sinful. I mean someone that you've lost, that you've loved. Ultimately, the reason that they died was because sin entered this world one time. It's not a pleasant struggle. This last year, we've struggled with sin, the world. We get all in these debates about government and masking and all that sort of stuff. And oh man, it's terrible. Yeah, it is. It's tough. The pandemic, all of the struggles around our world. Man, I mean, it's great. This Sunday, this is the first Sunday in a long time we've been able to meet like this. We want to make the government, we want to make others our enemy and stuff. Like, you know what? It's sin. This world around us, it's a struggle. It's a flat-out struggle. But if it was, you know, just a struggle with those out there, I suddenly discovered in my life that there's something in here. Take all of those bad people away. Take all of the world system away, and I'll still sin. If you want to test that theory, have children. They're beautiful, wonderful, but I didn't teach them. I don't remember teaching them to lie or to hit their siblings, to fight. It comes quite naturally, it seems, to them. And I have discovered in my adult life, take all of those external temptations and difficulties away, and there's still a battle with sin that's going on in here. It's a struggle. It's a throwdown with sin. And then to make matters worse, of course, there is the devil. The scripture tells us there is this being called Satan, the devil, who is like a roaring lion seeking to devour. Sin wants to have you. It's crouching at your door. It's a throwdown with sin. But I want to, before we talk about discipline and how we see God's loving hand in that, just a reality check. Verse 4, reality check. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted the point of shedding your blood. You've heard about, you know, blood, sweat, and tears. I'm sorry, but for most of us, according to this verse, it's going to be mostly sweat and tears. We have it tough sometimes. We experience loss. We experience struggle in our lives, but let's be honest. It's mostly sweat and tears. It's not much blood. I've never experienced bloodshed because of the cause of Christ and my struggle against sin. We have a lot of first world problems. We've had a tough time this last year and a half, no doubt about it. I'm not minimizing that. There's been a lot of sweat and tears over this, a lot of sweat this last week. With a lot of sweat and tears and fighting and bickering and difficulties because of COVID and all this stuff. But there hasn't been bloodshed. At least I haven't seen any. Maybe there have been some fights that you had in your family. But man, there are people that are dying because of their faith. I thank God that I don't have to experience that, at least so far. Reality check. It's mostly sweat and tears. But let's look at this father. He's our coach. Our Father is the coach, and He loves us. And one of those things He does, because He is an authoritative father, parent, is He disciplines us. And that's not easy. Discipline's not easy in the moment. It's not comfortable. We don't like it. But that ought to motivate us to live our Christian lives. Now, how does that work? Because we know God's love. Look at verse 9. We've all had human fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of our spirits? So we've had fleshly fathers. We have a heavenly Father. He's the Father of our spirits. And live. Our fathers disciplined us for a little while as they thought best, but God disciplines us for our goodness, that we may share in His holiness. Sharing in His holiness. You drop down to verse 14. It says, without holiness, no one will see the Lord. Seeing God. There's something about discipline that gives us a different view of God and what He's like. That just the good times and the easy things do not teach us about God. Seeing God, you really want to see what He's like. And I don't mean you become a Christian. I don't think that's what this is talking about. I think this is about experiencing those difficulties and the struggle and the straight out, you know, smack down with sin, and God bringing discipline into our lives teaches us something about God we would not know otherwise. And that's to see His holiness and to participate in that with Him. Here's a big tip off. I wondered why in Hebrews chapter 11, read through this passage, some great heroes of faith. We read about, you know, Enoch who walked with God. We read about Abraham, and we read about, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. There's a couple of guys there that are strangely absent from the list. David, probably inferred here. But you know the one that I really wonder why he's not there? Is Job. Why is Job not on the list? I mean, here's a guy who lost everything. Got to the point, you know, after losing his children and losing his livestock and herds, that his wife's, you know, borderline losing his wife, and his wife told him, curse God and die. Let it just be done. At the end, even though he had all this goodness and all this faith and everything, I think it's hinted at in these verses that talk about seeing God's holiness. Because after all of that last chapter in the book of Job, Job says this. It's a stunning verse. Job 42, verse 5. It says, my ears had heard of you. I'd heard about you, God. But now my eyes have seen you. There's something that we experience in this struggle and the disciplining of God and our battle with sin that we will not experience in all the good times of life. Maybe you've heard about God, and maybe you're a Christian, and you've started walking this Christian life, and difficulties come up, and you wonder why, and why you should continue on. Oh, there's a journey here. You'll learn some things about God. Like Job, you'll really see God. You'll see that holiness. You'll see what life is meant to be lived according to this verse here that says, how much more the discipline of our spirit, the Father of our spirits, and live, really, truly to live life. Discipline is this sweet, sometimes painful reality of a relationship with a loving Father. They call them Team Hoyt, or they did call them Team Hoyt. As of 2016, the father-son duo of Dick and Rick Hoyt had competed together in over 1,100 endurance events, and that included 71 marathons, as well as 7 Ironman triathlons. They ran in the Boston Marathon 32 times. There's a statue of them outside the Boston Marathon starting point. And they did more than that. They ran across the United States almost 4,000 miles in 45 days, this father-son duo. But the difference with this father-son duo that would starkly set them apart from others is that the son, Rick Hoyt, was diagnosed with cerebral palsy when he was born. His umbilical cord was wrapped around his neck, and it caused a blockage of oxygen to his brain. And so he was born without use of much of his limbs, unable to control his muscles. Doctors told Rick Hoyt's parents, Dick Hoyt, his dad, is just institutionalized him. This son will never read. He'll never talk. He'll never. They decided to work with him, and some incredible things happened. He never did walk. Team Hoyt began in 1977 when Rick asked his dad if they could run in a race together. Of course, Rick doesn't walk even. But he wanted to raise money for a lacrosse player at his school who had become paralyzed, and he wanted to prove that life went on no matter what your disability. And so his dad, who was a retired lieutenant colonel in the Air National Guard in the United States, he wasn't a runner, but he wanted to help his son want to do this. And so they rigged up a wheelchair, and he started training. Son was busy, so he put a sandbag in the chair and started training, and they ran that race together. And after running the race, he said to his dad, he says, "Dad, when I run, I feel... feels like I'm not handicapped. And I wonder what it would be like." I'm going to sit on this. This is the mercy seat, okay, so it's safe for me to sit on, I think. "I wonder what it would be like if you're in that wheelchair and your dad is behind you and he's pushing and he's running. I mean, effectively, your dad is doing all the work, really. It's such a picture of the Christian life. He disciplines us, and yet he's really doing the work. When he asks us to be disciplined and to endure what? The sweat that's rolling down in the middle of the race. And feeling the breeze in our hair as dad's pushing. In the triathlon, jumping into the water. Being in that lifeboat while dad is up front. The rope around his arms and he's swimming. Getting on the bike, strapped in. We just have to kind of hold on and wave to the crowd while our dad is running. And the wind. And every mile you go of the sweat, of the difficulty, one more mile that you're walking, you're running with your father." That's what our life as a Christian is like. I don't want to minimize the struggle against sin. It's hard. But every mile and every struggle is one more day to say, "God, I'm doing this with you." Dick Hoyt died just a couple months ago, the father, March of 2021. Their last race, I think, was in 2016. He said when his dad died, he wasn't going to race anymore. He had other people that would push him. He was such an inspiration. But running with his father was completely different. I don't know what you're going through, and I don't know what struggles that grip you every day in your battle and your throwdown with sin. But I do know this, and we'll all have those battles, that every day is an opportunity to say, "God, satisfy me with your love. I want to know what it's like to walk with you." And when you need to, let there be the sweat. Let there be the tears. I love this song. "When the sun comes up, for the day is done, satisfy me with your love." So would you stand as the team leads us in singing this song as we close?